Anyway, hello ladies and gentlemen. Wonderful, oh there you are. Wonderful to see so many of you. And thank you very much for coming for this inaugural event. And my name is Mark Cocker. I'm an author, naturalist and environmental activist. And I'm the chair for this evening. This is an innovative debate on a hot contemporary subject. And it's entitled Tooth and Claw. And has been brought to you by the wonderful Writers' Centre Norwich. But it's also originated with the founding of another organisation called the Norfolk Festival of Nature, which seeks to showcase the deep interconnection between culture and nature. Essentially, it argues that our imaginations are immeasurably enriched by connection to the diversity of life in our surroundings. Lose wildlife and nature and you lose the very stuff of human creativity. So remember that name for the future. It's just got underway. It's called the Norfolk Festival of Nature. Anyway, I'm delighted to be a chair, and I'll just briefly run through the format. We have three illustrious speakers who will give a short statement for about 3 minutes on their respective views concerning raptors and raptor persecution and the legal or illegal killing of raptors. And then there'll be about 20 minutes of direct discussion between the three of them as they argue their respective cases. But we really hope that this is a participatory event, that you will all want to take part, and we hope there'll be questions from the floor on the issues and you'll join the conversation. So without further ado, I'll introduce the three of them in alphabetical order. On our left is Dr. Mark Avery. He's a scientist by training and a naturalist by inclination. He writes about and comments on environmental issues. His books include Fighting for Birds and his recent superb A Message from Martha, an account of the extinction of the most numerous bird ever to have existed on Earth, the passenger pigeon. Mark worked for the RSPB for 25 years until standing down in April 2011 to go freelance. He was the RSPB's conservation director for nearly 13 years. He lives in rural Northamptonshire and is a member of Cheltenham Racecourse, the RSPB, the Wildlife Trust, the BTO, Bug Life, Plant Life, Butterfly Conservation, Pond Conservation, the Hawk and Owl Trust, the League Against Cruel Sports, the National Trust,
and the Labour Party.
Robin Page on your right or next to me. Sorry, what am I doing? Jake Fiennes is the second in alphabetical order. Jake is in the middle. Jake is one of the most gifted in a hugely gifted family. He left formal education at 16 after being at 13 different state schools, he insists I point out. As a young man, he was a cowboy on Australian ranches, a period that was bookended by two stints as gamekeeper. Firstly, on one of the most innovative rewilding projects in Sussex run by his friend Charlie Burrell, then on a big commercial shoot in Wales, which he happily left after just 12 months. For the last 20 years, he's been in East Norfolk as gamekeeper and now a state manager of the Raveningham Estate, which he runs lock, stock and barrel. His work there is astonishing, and I just wish that more of Norfolk was managed in exactly the same way. His practice has won or been shortlisted for numerous environmental prizes, including the Silver Lapwing, the Ian Nicol, and the Purdy Awards. Last but not least is Robin. Robin Page is a farmer, journalist, political activist, and former television presenter, and neither a shrinking violet nor a stranger to controversy. He presented the popular One Man and His Dog, a television show featuring sheepdog trials. He's chairman of the Countryside Restoration Trust, author of numerous books on the countryside and country life, and a regular columnist for the Daily Telegraph. His articles appear in many other publications. He's also had a long political career, having been elected to South Cambridgeshire District Council as an independent in 72, holding his seat until he resigned in 2006. He stood for the Conservative, this is quite remarkable, he stood for the Conservative Party, the Referendum Party, the UKIP Independence Party, and finally the UK First Party, before standing at the last election as an independent. So those are your three panellists.
The election before last.
The election before last. You didn't stand in 2015.
I didn't stand and I didn't vote, I'm proud to say.
So without further ado, each of our three panellists in that order, will give a short statement. Thanks very much, Mark.
Okay, thank you very much. Good evening. I'm not entirely sure why we're here. Birds of prey eat things. That's what they do. That's what they evolved to do. Get over it. They're lovely. When I left home this morning, I was watching some blue tits going into a nest box in my garden. They're vicious little predators, blue tits. They were pouring in and out with small beetles, flies, moth larvae, hundreds of them. Do we worry about that? Do we think that we should do something, go out and cull some blue tits? No, we don't. Now, if they started trying to take pheasants into that nest box, it would first of all be quite an achievement, but then some people would get uptight about it. Most species are predators, most species are prey as well. So let's take those blue tits or great tits in Whiteham Woods outside Oxford. These days, about 40% of all the great tits fledged in Whiteham Woods are eaten by sparrowhawks. That's a lot. But there are the same number of great tits nesting in Whiteham Woods now as there were in the 60s when there were no sparrowhawks at all. And so sparrowhawks weren't eating any great tits. It's not predators that drive, on the whole, the numbers of their prey. Some of you look old enough that you could have been wandering around Norwich in the 60s and 70s when you would hardly have seen a sparrowhawk in East Anglia. Were you wandering along the streets, kicking blue tits and great tits off the pavement because there were huge numbers of them, because they weren't being eaten by sparrowhawks? Of course you were. It's just ridiculous. One last story. In Ireland, they introduced a big mistake, the grey squirrel, on the east coast. It spread across Ireland, pushing red squirrels towards the west. Red squirrels declined because of competition and because of disease. In recent years, a remarkable thing has happened because pine martins have increased in Ireland and they have spread eastwards. And as pine martins have spread eastwards, grey squirrels have melted in front of them. Grey squirrels have declined in numbers as a natural predator comes back into the system. And behind the pine martins are coming red squirrels. That's what you'd expect. So our landed gentry made the mistake of getting rid of pine martins hundreds and hundreds of years ago, then the mistake of letting grey squirrels go. They had an easy time, and I suspect the people who will most complain about putting pine martins back to solve this problem will be the landowners who are afraid of anything with sharp teeth or a hooked beak.
Thank you very much.
Right, good evening everybody. It's a pleasure to be here. I have 30 years experience in land management, all in the private sector and on large rural estates. My personal aims are the creation of new and successful habitats and the maintenance of others, bringing them into favourable condition. All habitats have to deliver sustainable populations of flora and fauna. This can only be achieved at a landscape level, increasing fragile populations whether local or national, can best be achieved by collaboration of nature. Whatever one's belief are the rights and the privilege of others, we cannot get away from the fact that 80% of the UK is owned by 1% of the population. It is fundamentally important that those in this privileged position maintain and enhance what is theirs for their tenure and passes on to the next generation in a better condition than they took it on. The rural landscape is ever-changing, and what was good practice for one generation will not necessarily suit the next. We cannot get away from the fact that a proportion of this privately owned land has a game interest. The perception of others is that game management is ruthless and indiscriminate to all species other than the quarry that is pursued. This is an outdated and ill-informed. Modern gamekeeping and good game habitat management can have huge benefits to wide variety of species. A 20th century lowland gamekeeper's perception of what is a threat to his stock is not avian predation. Invariably, birds are bought in at poults up to 7 weeks old and released from pens over a period of 4 to 6 weeks. I freely admit that large quantities of birds in a confined space for a short period of time is dinner on a plate for most avian predators. But ironically, the greatest threat to the modern gamekeeper is the modern motor car. Large proportion of rural estates enter into government and European-funded land management schemes. Most successful are those overseen and managed by those with a genuine interest to deliver and succeed. I think you'll find that a gamekeeper is either in the forefront or in the background, irrespective of the direct benefits to his stock. None of us in this room can deny the magnificence and splendour of avian predators. We have seen an increase in populations over the last 30 years across the predatory species. The main reason is not the reduction in gamekeepers, currently at about 4,500, previously 25,000. But the recovery from the huge detrimental effect of pesticides in the 50s and 60s with secondary poisoning, DDT. The fluctuation in species number, either up or down, is caused by a range of factors: availability of food, removal of habitat, intensification of agriculture, and undermanaged woodland. I wholeheartedly condemn the actions of few which tarnish the name of the vast majority. In my career, I strive to put things in place and deliver at the earliest opportunity. I am truly saddened by the lack of reasonable dialogue between others and their choice of rhetoric, all too often delivered via anonymous cyberspace, which fails to engage properly with the issues in hand.
Thank you. And now, Robin.
I'm here quite simply because I'm passionate about the British countryside, its wildlife, its culture, and its traditional country people. And so my view of the countryside is not a shrunken view, it's a wide view of everything that is out there and why it's out there. I'm not speaking here because of some skewered computer model has given me figures that I can use correctly or incorrectly. I'm not speaking here because a marketing man wants me to say something trite or memorable, or I'm after a research grant. I'm speaking here because I was born in the countryside, I live in the countryside, I live 100 yards away from where I was born. I have seen populations rise, I've seen them fall, and I've seen the reasons behind many of them. And I don't need scientists to tell me what I've actually seen with my eyes. I'm here to talk about the countryside that I love, that is being trashed by incompetent politicians, by absurd farmers who talk about sustainable intensification, which is, as you can see, a contradiction of terms. And I am fed up with the coalition of designer conservationists and hobby bird watchers who simply see the countryside as the theme park for their own feathered version of train spotting. We have too many people in this country. We're overpopulated. We have too little land. Food security is an issue and always ignored. That means we have a crisis. That means to keep our wildlife, we have to manage our wildlife, we have to manage habitat, and we have to manage species. Our activities have put nature out of balance, and we have to try and create an artificial balance because we are one of the most densely populated countries in the world. And we cannot imagine that this is a great area of savannah. It is not. To help all this, we allegedly have nature reserves that are supposed to save nature. We have 50,000 agri-environment schemes covering 16 million acres, but still it's not working. Our wildlife is tumbling. We're trying to make habitat. It's not being successful. We are ignoring the huge army of predators that is walking the land. Domestic cats, selfish dog walkers with their pooches by the million. Foxes, badgers, rats, crows, magpies, jays, and some raptors. In irrational England, raptor rapture has made raptors safer in Britain than sacred cows in New Delhi. raptors, yes, buzzards, kites, sparrowhawks, and in parts of East Anglia, marsh harriers, that happen to be one of my favourite birds, are creating absolute havoc. And I won't even start on hen harriers, because the rubbish that is talked about hen harriers, they don't even understand what the title hen harrier clearly means. I care about lapwings, I care about skylarks, I care about leverets, and I care about the species that are actually vanishing. One bird that has vanished in the 80s, the roseate tern, disappeared from Anglesey, 200 pairs, because the RSPB would not control or limit one pair of peregrines and one fox. They sacrificed 200 pairs of roseate terns and they have not returned. They have gone off to the Bay of Dublin. We won't see them again. It is time all this pie in the sky of denial was replaced by common sense and honesty. And then perhaps we will get the great diversity of our wildlife back again.
Guys, common sense and honesty, Mark? Or Jake? Jake, what, first of all, what did you think?
First of all, I was just going to walk out the door and leave it to these two.
Don't do that. You stay there.
What do you think of Robin's idea that raptor populations are... The loss of wildlife in this country is partly to do with density of birds of prey populations?
That is what you're saying, is it, Robin? We just check that.
If you listen, which you rarely do, Mark, I mentioned cats, yeah, I mentioned dogs, I mentioned foxes, I mentioned badgers. There is a raft of predators, which includes birds of prey, and you will know as a scientist that there is a scientific impact on birds. And it's been done. The role of the Eurasian sparrowhawk in the decline of the house sparrow in Britain by Christopher Bell and various people from Cambridge University. And it was published in New York in America. There is scientific detail on what has happened to the sparrow. And it was recently also confirmed by the BTO, the Garden Bird Feeding Survey. This has revealed a correlation between the abundance of house sparrows and their sparrowhawk predators. The number of house sparrows visiting garden feeding stations fell at feeding stations where the number of sparrowhawks has increased over the last 40 years. Common sense, backed up by science, denied by Mark, and denied too in The Guardian that he feeds information. When I had a journalist contact me earlier in the week, he said, "Where's the science?" I said, "I'm not a scientist." I gave him where to go for the science, and of course he didn't go, because that's The Guardian, and that's also how Mark works.
Hang on, the question I asked was of Jake. Jake, what did you think about the idea that common sense and honesty requires us to start thinking about, you know, controlling birds of prey populations in exactly the way that presumably Robin is calling for domestic cats, foxes and badgers also to be culled?
We can't deny that we've seen an increase in raptor populations.
No. Everyone agrees that.
And we applaud that. The problem is that their populations are governed by availability of food and habitat. And until we provide sufficient food and habitat for their prey species to either avoid them or breed successfully, then we'll constantly have this imbalance. And the agri-environment schemes quite clearly haven't delivered. A range of factors. You've seen what I do. Yeah. I go 110% to deliver. But there are plenty out there that the agri-environment schemes, the early ones, were considered as compensation for modulation of single payment. Mm-hmm. So a lot of farms, although this huge land area and these statistics that come out for areas that are delivered through environmental schemes, they're not worth the land they're on because they just quite clearly don't deliver. And it's down to the individual land managers, farmers, gamekeepers, to make them deliver.
Yeah. Do you think, though, that in the absence of success with these agri-environment schemes, that there could be an interim period of controlling raptors to reduce their impact, or are you happy to row in with a standard environmental position, which is that raptors are part of a natural ecosystem, and the thing to do is to improve the habitat?
If you look at the recovery from DDT of sparrowhawks, where the graph goes up, and now the graph is fairly static. That means that they've met their food source. We then, on the BTO breeding bird survey, they're not quite sure there is a correlation with songbird numbers. They haven't come. That scientific research isn't conclusive. Mm-hmm. That's why there's this argument that our raptors, let's use sparrowhawks as an example, suppressing small bird numbers. I think the habitat for small bird numbers isn't right.
No.
So the balance, it's out of kilter. Mm-hmm. And I think we need to address that through habitat. But if we address small bird populations, then the sparrow numbers will increase again.
Yeah.
So, okay. And it's, you know, we'll only have as many sparrowhawks as much food there is available.
Yeah, can I hold you there? Mark, what did you think of the idea that you are lacking, you're a designer, conservationist, and a hobby bird watcher in one, and that you're ignoring common sense in simply insisting on raptor populations to increase when, you know, all the evidence of our eyes is that if you watch the birds on the bird table, they're being hammered by these sparrowhawks taking bluetits, etc.
So they eat things. That's what they do. That's what they've always done. If you're looking for common sense, I found quite a lot of it from Jake. I wouldn't differ much from what he said. I would probably put some things slightly differently. I would certainly have pointed out that every person in this room is funding the agri-environment scheme. So although all that land is owned by private landowners, it is funded. A lot of the money going into it is funded by all of us. So we all have a say in what happens to that land. I'm not going to rise to everything that Robin says about me, because you can listen to me if you want to hear what I say, not listen to Robin. But for someone who loves the countryside, he produced a long list of things that he thought were rather nasty, didn't he? I mean, mammals, birds, cats. I'm not terribly keen on cats, I have to say. But it was a very long list. So just about all the science, the biggest science that has been done on this issue suggests, and it could be wrong, but I don't think it is wrong, suggests that there's very little impact of sparrowhawks and other predators on their prey species. Sparrowhawks eat lots of things. When one species of bird gets a bit rarer, they will switch to another one that's a bit commoner, and the one that's got rarer will get a bit commoner again. I was in southern Spain a few weeks ago, and you just sit there, and the sky is full of raptors. It's full of black kites and red kites and kestrels and hobbies and lesser kestrels and griffon vultures and booted eagles and the occasional buzzard and marsh harriers and Montagu's harriers and a load of other things I can't remember, short-tailed eagle. It's just full of birds of prey. As you walk around, it's full of small birds. It's absolutely lifting with small birds in the way that our countryside isn't. So I'd agree with Jake that if we get the habitat right, and agri-environment schemes have not worked as well as they should, I blame the NFU, they've been awful. But agri-environment schemes have not worked as well as they should, even though about 3/4 of £1 billion of your money is going into them. They haven't delivered very much. If we could get that right, we would have better habitat, we would have more small birds, and we probably would have some more raptors too. And would we mind? No, we wouldn't. We'd be very happy, unless we were running a pheasant shoot, probably. And that's where a lot of the angst about birds of prey comes from.
Robin, I just wanted to pick up one thing that you said, that you listed all the predators which are having an impact. I mean, why wouldn't you campaign on domestic cats as vociferously?
I do write about domestic cats vociferously. I write about dogs. I also write about people throwing dog poo in hedges and all that sort of thing. But you lot are very selective in what you take exception to. And so you mention raptor, and it's, you mention anything else, and it just passes you by. I'm afraid you are obsessed. You're obsessive. Now then, no, let me come back to this. Because one thing we're missing out is, Mark touched upon it, preferential hunting and feeding. Just like you, and obviously like Mark, some birds of prey have favourite food. And for instance, in the ewes washes, the RSPB, he didn't tell me, but what used to be the Wildfowl Trust did, was they had sparrowhawks which were specialising in taking snipe. And they had virtually wiped out the snipe from the ewes washes. Okay, then when the snipe are very scarce, they switch to something else. When the snipe try and come back, they're immediately hammered again, and that is called, the scientists call it, the predator pit. And it keeps populations very, very low, too low. Mark can tell us all the scientific detail about the predator pit, but he won't. And then we also have other problems, like if you go to the Nene washes, I have been trying to get information for 10 years from the RSPB about the link between black-tailed godwit nests, the number of fledged black-tailed godwits, and the number of black-tailed godwits that are predated, as far as they know, from marsh harriers or sparrowhawks or any other. Although I'm a member of the RSPB, although I am a journalist, they will give me no information whatsoever. So how can you make rational arguments when the body with the information refuses to give it to you? What are they covering up?
I mean, you said, Robin, that...
You should know, you were there.
Okay.
Long enough.
Want to come back, Mark?
Black-tailed godwits, where I was at the Nene washes a few weeks ago, they were at record levels this year. So don't worry about black-tailed godwits.
That's a non-answer.
Well, I don't think it is. They will get eaten
by foxes.
Well, there are about 45 pairs, but I don't know exactly. That is about 95% of the whole UK population on this reserve, which you say is being badly managed. I don't know how you
I didn't. I said I can't get information. You see, you make things up. You're a scientist.
I must be taking my lead from you. But the population of black-tailed godwits is fine at Nene washes. Yes, they will be eaten by things, they will have good years and bad years, but there are more black-tailed godwits at Nene washes than there were about 10 years ago, I think. Although I haven't worked for the RSPB for 4 years, but it's clear from the way that you speak, you would add the RSPB to your long list of bits of British wildlife that you don't like. And as well, is it between the badger and the cat, or where does it fit?
Well, certainly at the RSPB Hope Farm.
Oh, that's a good example.
Where the biggest mammalian predator of skylarks is badgers, and they refuse to make it public.
Okay, let's talk about Hope Farm. Hope Farm is not far from Countryside Restoration Trust.
You remember we were the first organisation to link in
wildlife. Okay. Well done.
In your book, you've forgotten to mention it.
No,
another slip up from a scientist. Well, there we go.
You can buy the said book, Fighting for Birds, downstairs.
Well,
you can see exactly what I did. But Hope Farm, the RSPB bought in 2000, I think, and I was the conservation director at the time. It was quite a risk. We bought an ordinary arable farm. Completely ordinary arable farm, and we stuck our necks out and said, if we manage this a bit differently, we will keep producing the same amount of wheat and oilseed rape as it produced before the RSPB bought it, and we will increase the number of farmland birds. The farmland bird index it went up to about three times its original level. Skylarks, which probably do get eaten by badgers, I'm sure they do sometimes, skylark numbers went from 10 in the first year to over 40 in some years, and they're still at about 30. Now, if every farm in the country did the same things as the RSPB did at Hope Farm, we would have more small birds, and there's not a single fox, raptor, stoat that has been killed on that land. So it shows you can produce more birds, the same amount of food, and you don't have to go around killing everything.
Jake, do you want to come in on that? Because Raveningham has been very successful at breeding waders, etc.
I'm not sure I know a bit about Hope Farm, but not an awful lot. Some people refer it as Hopeless Farm.
Data are published, you should look them up, because the bird numbers have gone up and the yields of crops have stayed the same.
I'm sure the yields of crops stay the same. Where was the starting block? If it was a traditionally run farm, then the starting block of the bird populations would be pretty catastrophic. Which is pretty catastrophic.
Absolutely.
So your increase of three times of one isn't a sustainable increase.
Well, it is sustainable because it's lasted for 15 years and it's only using the same amounts of money and agri-environment schemes that are available to every farmer in England. And it's producing as much food, slightly more actually, but that's with the general trend, slightly more food than it did when the RSPB bought it. What's not to like about that? Producing more food, more wildlife, it's a win-win situation.
But I don't think it's sufficiently enough wildlife.
Well, if you compare the farmland bird index of farms in the east of England in Cambridgeshire, so similar farms around Hope Farm, the farmland bird index has remained level. The farmland index on this small bit of Hope Farm has trebled. If my salary had trebled at a time when everybody else's salary over 15 years had stayed the same, I would say that's pretty much a success, and so would you. So I can't see what's wrong with that.
But having said that, I mean, I was just recently in Upper Teesdale in County Durham, where they have a rigorously keepered environment, huge estate owned by Lord Barnard. Yes, he suppresses lots of unwanted predators, and the impression was that that might have included some things that were legally protected. But what was manifestly apparent was the wader populations were at astonishing levels compared with anything you will find almost anywhere else. So, you know, we have got landscapes left with the snipe. I mean, I saw five or six drumming snipe in one. You know, and much as you might not like it, those are producing the last significant wader.
I do like it. You're copying him now. You're telling me what I like. You're quite right. Those upland grouse moors are spectacular in numbers of waders. They don't have many birds of prey on them. They ought to have a lot more. Predator control is incredibly intense. So I stood on the Durham Moors a few weeks ago as well, and it was fantastic. There were golden plovers, there were lapwings, there were curlews, just brilliant. The moor where I stood killed 400 stoats a year. And that kind of made me think, if there was a pile of 400 dead stoats by the road, side of the road when I'm looking at these waders, would I feel quite the same about it? And also the management of that land is increasing flood risk, increasing water pollution, increasing greenhouse gas emissions, and destroying blanket bogs through overburning. So it's not a sustainable management regime, and you're all paying for it. You're paying for it in agri-environment payments, and you're also paying for it in increased house insurance, because if flood risk goes up, then you pay through your insurance. If water courses are polluted, then you pay because Yorkshire Water take the pollution out of the water. They don't do that for free. They pass that cost on to you. So I would look at that whole ecosystem, not in terms of a few predators being taken out, but whether it works overall, and I don't think it works overall. And if it worked overall, then the Scandinavians, the Canadians and the Russians would all be doing the same thing. Are they rushing to introduce driven grouse shooting into their uplands? No. There must be a reason for that. They've got more sense.
The estate, I spoke to Natural England, and they are blocking up all the drains. They are planting habitat for black grouse. They are changing their regime to take account of bird populations. They're increasing tree cover, which includes habitat for carrion crows, etc. So, you know, the estate management is rowing in with those kinds of objectives, such as carbon sequestration by making the peatland more sustainable and a healthier environment. So some of those actions are taking place.
Yeah, could I say that you hit the nail on the head, which I wanted to bring up, but I only just managed to speak again. And that is because all this is in higher level stewardship. And it is all passed by Natural England. And Natural England actually tell the owners how much to burn and how much not to burn. And so it all comes under the government's conservation arm, which Mark is telling us that they're all idiots, they don't know what they're doing.
I didn't say that it's
disgraceful. But yet, these are the rules by our nature organisation, Quango, that has produced this. And what he should also realise, that when they're dealing with heather, there are things like hot burns and there are cool burns, which are all part of the process. And these people know what they're doing. Martina Tyrrell, a doctor who studies anthropology, says that we should take notice of the people who work the land to use their non-scientific expertise, because the gamekeepers, the foresters, the farmers, shepherds, and the people who run the land often know more than the scientists who try and tell them what they should be doing. And she is a scientist. But I will just say one more thing. That it's all right for Mark to say, oh, well, if we had a pile of dead stoats, go to Burney Marshes, the RSPB reserve. They said in the paper that because of the way they managed the land, lapwing had gone up 392%. Redshank, this is under Mark's watch, Redshank 486% in 5 years. I said, okay, how are you doing it? They said, we're shooting foxes and crows. And in the first spring, they shot 40 foxes. So on this basis, Mark would like to see a pile of 40 dead foxes as you go.
He isn't personally responsible for that.
No, come on. You get the drift. He is just playing to the bunny huggers of the world. And I have to tell you, too, that what else goes on RSPB reserves is that they will cut reed beds when marsh harriers are coming back and wanting to nest, specifically to make the marsh harriers move on. If that was a gamekeeper on moorland doing the same thing with hen harriers, there would be press releases and horror.
Jay, do you want to come in on your experience of Natural England? Yeah,
first of all, I freely admit we are all stakeholders, you know, everyone, and so as a land manager, I'm responsible to deliver environmental benefits on your behalf. So I freely admit that. And Robin's absolutely right. The prescriptions that are written by someone I can be very politically incorrect at times, so I'm trying to force myself from not being politically incorrect. But
you're doing very well so far.
But from someone, let's say, named Kevin in a office block in Wolverhampton, writes his prescription for a management for pollen nectar species to his prescriptions are very different for someone on the Scottish Moors or someone in Cornwall or someone in Norfolk. So what you have to, you could, everywhere is different. You can't treat everything the same way. So we have to, what I've done is I've actually developed my own prescriptions that suit the environment that I work in. And I have that flexibility and I get derogation after derogation. There's a lot of paperwork, there's a lot of phone calls. So I'm enabled to my scheme to deliver. Now that is something that Natural England need to address. You can have key people in Natural England that are hugely helpful.
Why do you think Natural England are not being sensible and being commonsensical about managing land that increases habitat?
Entry level, the initial, the sort of the first tier of environmental was a very. At one stage, we were told for not cutting our hedges, we'd get the grant not to cut our hedges. But not cutting hedges is detrimental to wildlife. You have to manage your hedges. There's certain times of year where we destroy habitat purely for the benefit, because it's ever changing and ever evolving, so you have to work with it. With regard predator control, if I put a gamekeeper hat on, foxes and crows are the main predators. At certain times of year, it is key that they are managed and their populations are reduced to benefit sensitive species. Lapwing, grey partridge, stone curlew, sort of key Norfolk species. And the RSPB do this on their reserves. And Mark Smart, who manages Burnie Marshes very well, he had that period where there was no predator control. He then had the period of, I helped him source night vision, and that's been hugely effective, and the results demonstrate that. So it demonstrates that predator control is fundamentally important for the diversity of species.
But not raptor control. So you're right on Burnie Marshes. I'd forgotten Burnie Marshes. I was
convenient. Well, there you go.
I'm indebted to you for reminding
us. Yes, short-term memory loss can be a great advantage.
Robin, shut up. Because at Burnie Marshes, unlike most of the other nature reserves that the RSPB had where we did similar things, it was actually quite clear that killing foxes and some crows actually really worked there. On other reserves, it definitely didn't. So we didn't waste our money doing it in other places. But this has moved quite a long way away from raptors. Mm-hmm. Because they're... Which are the species of raptors that Robin would like to see controlled, as in his article in the Daily Mail last week? Because that's what you were saying.
Well, I make it quite clear. I have said you don't go out and shoot the raptors. You actually control them by nest management.
Hang on, Robin. Can we throw this open to the audience now? We've had... Yeah. This gentleman over here.
Yeah, my name's Nigel Milton. I'd like to just address what some of the things that Robin has said. From one country boy to another country boy. Oh, sorry. Yes, my name is Nigel Milton. I'd just like to address from one country boy to another country boy who professes to be a country boy. I'm no scientist. I run and manage 83 hectares of land under a high-level stewardship scheme. And the main objectives for me to manage this land is for raptors, because I work for an organisation that actually professes to protect and enhance habitat for raptors. On that land, we have marsh harriers breeding, we have two pairs of sparrowhawks breeding, we have buzzards breeding, we have barn owls, tawny owls, kestrels on the periphery, and bivalves. Right? It's a good raptor number. I also have a very good population of bullfinches, all the tit species, marsh tits included, nuthatches. None of those species have declined. I've got another gentleman in this audience who can actually, he rings all the pulley on these sites, and we have a good population. And the only predator control we give there is grey squirrels for the small bird populations, because they are the ones that are actually doing the damage. The raptors don't have no damage whatsoever. As for Natural England, as Jake, I agree with Jake, some of the HLS stuff is not delivered how it should have been, but Natural England actually are very supportive. I work with Natural England very, very clearly. We get a payment, a very small payment, because we own a small amount of land. What we
say, well, look, this description you put into the basic description is just not right, not for this type of habitat that we're managing. And we adjust it. We have a very good population of everything. And the only thing that we control out of that is a grey squirrel that was introduced by
me. Could you pass the mic to the gentleman just to your behind you? Yeah. Let's have a range of questions.
I just think a couple of things. Firstly, I think we do not live in a natural environment. I don't know where you can go on this planet to find one, but I've yet to see one.
Absolutely.
Everywhere is managed, everywhere is influenced by man. So I think to say that we actually live in a natural environment and therefore can let the process of nature completely control things is not really going to happen. I think you need to actually look out there and you see that we don't live in one. So there's probably an element of management happening within this sort of falls of the cathedral. And to that end, I don't quite see how you cannot control a raptor if you want to keep a leveret. Something's going to win, something's going to lose. So I don't think you should be eradicating raptors. I don't think you should be eradicating leverets. I think an element of logic needs to come into play here from all sides of the argument. Because ultimately, I think what everyone actually in this room wants is for all species to grow in numbers, or to at least have species diversity. And in an environment where one species is allowed to flourish at the sort of at the cost of another, you're not actually going to achieve what everyone wants to do. And so I'd say to all three of you, I think everyone probably has a very good argument, but I think for the flexibility on all sides is what everyone needs.
Flexibility is what we need. Can we have flexibility? Do you think I can be, I mean, how does, what would flexibility lead to? What would be its impact?
Flexibility is quite simple. We have a very good relationship with Natural England, and on our trust farm at Lark Rise Farm, we have had spectacular increases in a wide range of not just birds, but also brown hares, harvest mice, water voles, etc. So we are looking at the whole thing. And you change your management to go with the flow. And so we have had a tremendous program of mink eradication. And just for Mark's benefit, a mink isn't a raptor, but yet it does cover a wide area, and we've cooperated with 45 other landowners, and because the mink has gone, then the water voles have come back, and this year, I haven't done any sorts of counts, but the reed warblers and sedge warblers, etc., are all doing brilliantly.
Robert, thanks, Robin. What about flexibility? Could we have flexibility? Would that work?
Well, I don't know what it means. We've got quite a lot of flexibility.
Well, what the gentleman means by flexibility is that we adopt different positions in different places, so that raptors would be persecuted in the case of...
Could I define what I mean by flexibility?
Yeah.
I think flexibility is... I think it involves actually adopting what the RSPB wants to do, in my view, which is to have a sort of utopia where all birds are allowed to flourish and nothing gets in the way. And I think it also goes to what the more extreme people want to do with raptors, which is to shoot them all. And I think it's a sort of a bit of a line down the middle, saying that actually utopia probably isn't going to exist, but actually at the same time we can't eradicate all raptors. So I think flexibility is just adopting a bit of both camps,
right,
and
okay,
being able to get a more harmonious environment as a result.
So your example was leverets. Where I grew up in the West Country, you never see a brown hare these days. That's not because of all the buzzards and other raptors. It's because farmers produce silage these days. They scrunch them up. I'm not saying they mean to scrunch that, but that's why there aren't many hares in the West Country. Where I live now, in Northamptonshire, there are loads of hares. Farmers complain about them. I'm not entirely sure why, but they moan like hell about them. And there are loads of buzzards and red kites, increasing numbers of sparrowhawks, who clearly aren't making any inroads into these brown hares. Now, you said, if a species is having an impact, then we ought to have flexibility. Well, we could, But you've got to use some science, rather than I've lived in the countryside all my life, to decide which species are having an impact.
But what is the science of your area that you've just quoted? You have just said that they're having no impact at all. But for instance, have you got any information? Have you got any adverse impact assessment on the red kite introduction into Buckinghamshire? No, you haven't. Did you put any environmental impact assessment before they were released? If you did, nobody's seen them. And so you talk about science and then you don't produce it. What is the adverse impact of red kites in Buckinghamshire and Oxfordshire? What about Just let me tell you this. Charwell Valley, and you have wader restoration projects that are being wrecked.
Hang on, Robin,
through
let's just deal
buzzards
with let's
deal and with badgers, time. And they're spending thousands of pounds being wasted because all the waders they want to get back, all the chicks and the eggs are being predated.
Let's go back to adverse effect of red kites in Buckinghamshire and Oxfordshire.
I don't know of any. I don't know of any. I live in Northamptonshire. When I grew up in Bristol, I had to go to Mid Wales to see a red kite, because that was the only place you could go and see them.
Well, I
over my garden these days, I can see a red kite any day. I can tell you that my kids have grown up. When I took them to music lessons, football, they would go, "Oh, Dad, there's a red kite." They are the first generation of children in Northamptonshire for 150 years who've grown up with red kites as a normal part of their lives. And I think that is fantastic. And so does every primary school in Northamptonshire. They all want the red kite to be the logo of their school. They all, when they go out, some of the kids are quite small, they run around in the playground and the red kites come and swoop over them. Those kids love that. They have had their heritage removed for 150 years because people have killed and poisoned those birds for no good reason. Let's bring them back.
Hang on, Mark.
Be relaxed.
Quick point from Jake and then two questions over here.
So red kite, allegedly the carrion feeder, you know, not that detrimental on other species. I'm sure everyone has an opinion on that. If I can use buzzard as an example, another species that has rocketed. In the 20 years of living in Norfolk, I never saw a buzzard when I first arrived here. Now, I can stand outside my front door and within an hour I'll see buzzards.
And what impact do you think they're having?
What impact do I think they're having? I'm not seeing an impact. I'm seeing a lot of buzzards, but I'm not seeing an impact.
Okay.
I provide other species for them to feed on. We have high rabbit populations, we have high hare populations. I'm not seeing on the area I manage a difference. But
so in other words, then you're saying it's habitat.
But then we talk about the control of buzzards. If you own an airport, you can get a license to control buzzards.
Mm-hmm.
If you have outdoor poultry and buzzards are attacking your poultry, you can get a license to control buzzards.
Mm-hmm.
If you have a game interest, you ain't got a cat's hell in chance of getting a license to control buzzards.
Okay, I'll leave.
Well, if you're the Stodey estate, you're caught with 10 dead buzzards in the bag.
Couple more questions here. One from the lady in the second row, and also the gentleman behind afterwards.
I'd like to ask Mr. Fines what sort of predator control you have on the Buckingham estate that every year your 50 Greek friends can come along and butcher hundreds of brown hare in an hour.
Hang on.
By walking over the fields and killing the shotguns that are inadequate, and the hares, as everyone can see on Facebook and on Google, the hares are not killed outright, and they are allowed to lay down and struggle and cry out. It's all I've seen with my own eyes, and I'm still not over it. Now I'd like to know what you have to do, or what don't you do, that enable your estate to have that many hares when nationally they're in decline. So why don't you do transplantation? Why don't you do something? Old men presumably paying your boss, Nicholas Bacon. to kill those animals.
This is not a wrapped question. Can we pass it?
I know.
Hang on. We'll just take another question. Hang on.
Yeah.
Can we take another question? Yeah.
Rick Walters, small
holder. No, can you use the mic so we can hear you?
Right. Want you to answer it.
Can you hear me?
Yeah, that's fine.
Thank you. Rick Walters, small holder. Entry level scheme, high level stewardship scheme. Very pleased with both. A few years ago was the idea of introducing the supreme raptor, that is the sea eagle. What is the panel's view on that?
What is the panel's view on white-tailed sea eagles? Jake, do you want to briefly answer the hares? It's not a raptor question.
I briefly answer the hares. We have a vast array of habitats that support hares throughout the year. We control foxes, stoats, crows, weasels, rats. We do every species we're legally allowed to control. We control that benefits the hares. And the fundamentally, it's the habitat that increases the hare
population.
So why don't you kill them outright? If you're going to kill animals, you should kill them outright. Jake, look at me. We've seen you.
Hang on, madam. We've got a question at the back. Yeah, please. This is a debate about raptors, not about hares.
I go home to 50 badgers on my farm in North Suffolk. And I wish I never had one.
Be quick, we've got 5 minutes left. We've got to deal with the white-tailed eagle.
We've got no major chocolate. Last year we counted about 25 bumblebees left in one hedgerow that they dug out.
Okay, I'm going to hold you there. So there are two issues here. What about white-tailed eagles being reintroduced? And what about tackling the issue of badger predation?
Not reintroduced, introduced. They will never hear them.
That's a moot point, but reintroduction or the presence of white-tailed eagles in Norfolk. Mark?
They were here, so it would be reintroduced. I wish we had done. I think it's partly my fault. I chickened out. I wish we'd gone ahead and done it. But actually, the coalition government, before it became government, told Natural England that they wouldn't see. It would be a very unwise move for Natural England to put money into a sea eagle reintroduction, given that there are going to be cuts across the board. But I wish we'd done it, and it's partly my fault we didn't.
Robin, quickly.
Mark doesn't want eagle owls, as he doesn't, why is he saying that they were never native?
Like eagle owls.
And I would say I am very proud of the part I played in not getting the sea eagle in East Anglia, because I value our tern colonies so highly, our under pressure tern colonies, and they really don't want any more aggravation from predators, disturbance from these flying barn doors. It was an act of huge irresponsibility.
Okay, Jake, just briefly on badgers. What do you think about the fact that badgers are...
White-tailed eagles.
Okay.
I think let's try and get what we have right first before we start adding something else into the fray.
Okay.
Badgers, we have no badger sets on the estate, and we have high populations of hedgehogs. There is, hedgehogs allegedly are going to decline. We're going to be extinct by 2050.
Yeah.
I think you go to Europe, they have a season for controlling badgers.
They do.
It's a bit over the top, I think.
Okay. I think there is something in that. It is bizarre.
Unity.
That foxes, you can kill as many of them as you like, and badgers, you can't kill any of them.
Can I ask you?
Can't quite be right. Now, which way you go, we'd have to think about.
Can I ask one more question, a yes or no answer, or do you have more in common than divides you? Robin, yes or no? Do you have more in common than divides you?
I have quite a lot in common.
One word.
I'm sitting on the fence, that's many
Jake,
words.
Do you have more in common with each other than divides you?
We all strive for the same goal, which is diversity.
Yeah. Mark?
Yes with Jake, no with Robin.
Okay, thanks very much. Folks, I'm sorry.
That wasn't one word.
Thanks, guys.
Can I thank Mark Cocker as the chair of tonight's event?